Our guest is Tex Beneke, a name to reckon with from the music days, the great big band era days, and even these days. Tex is in town to talk about an appearance coming up at Ravinia Park on Wednesday, August the 10th, which is billed, I believe, as a the nostalgic sounds of the summer of 42.
Is that right? Yes, it certainly is, and we're going to have, of course, the beautiful Helen O'Connell with us, and Bob Eberle, who sang, the both of them sang with the Jimmy Dorsey Band at the time I was with the Miller Band. And this package that we have put together now, this is our second year, and it's just going great, because I like it better, really, than a lot of shows we have done with Paula Kelly and the Modernaires and Ray Eberle, Bob's brother, because with them, we can only do strictly the Miller things. Now, this way, we can split it up and give them half Miller and and half Dorsey things, like their Green Eyes and Amapola and all of those beautiful things that they made so big. So I'm enjoying working with them very much.
It's amazing how well that music holds up. People who never heard it before, a generation of people who were not there at the time it was really the only kind of music.
And we are finding around the country more and more young kids who are beginning to really dig the sounds of the big bands. They, I think they've finally found out there are more than three chords. And, and also I'm finding a lot of them dancing together. I think they
that's the new stuff again.
Yeah,
huh? Brand
sure.
New
they
thing.
They finally found out what they've been missing all these years.
Right. I went to a clothing store the other day, and I said, "How are you selling with these vested suits?" And he says, "Oh, they're going great guns." He says, "The kids today are buying suits they never wore vests before.
Yeah,
something new. The old stuff is new again.
It's cycling, you know, Chuck. It's cycling back around again, and of course to the young people, it's the big bands are a brand new sound for them, because they just their parents heard them in the earlier days, you know. And then they, I guess, were rummaging around in the garage someplace and found a bunch of these old dusty 78s and started to listen to them and began to like them.
Let's rummage around in your garage for a little while. Where did it start for you musically, Tex?
Well, in Fort Worth, actually, Chuck. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up down there, I started taking sax lessons when I was just 9 years old, and then I played all through high school, flunking all of my subjects and everything, because I was busy playing most of the nights and sleeping through classes. But then I worked with a lot of bands, with always with older fellas around the Texas, Oklahoma, Southwest area, and finally had this opportunity to for our band, which had played at the Billy Rose Texas Centennial in Fort Worth in 36. And we finally had the opportunity to get back east, up around Detroit, Cleveland. And I thought, well, hey, this is great. Maybe I'll get a chance to make New York, you know, one of these days. Mm-hmm. And one night, Gene Krupa came into our place where we were playing. And he had just left the Goodman Band and was looking for new talent for his new group that he was going to form. And very close friends, Gene recommended me to Glenn back at one of Gene's rehearsals there in New York. Krupa didn't take me. He already had his saxophone section filled up, but he did take a couple of trumpet men and a trombone player, and I was very disappointed, needless to say, because everybody knew who the great Krupa was, you know. Then it wasn't but just a short while thereafter that I got a call from a guy named Glenn Miller. And I didn't know who he was. No one did, really, except the studio men around New York City. Mm-hmm. And they knew him, of course, as a trombonist and as an arranger. But he wanted to start a band. He told me the whole thing, that he had gotten it all from Krupa, that that I was supposed to be a tenor man that Krupa thought that Glenn would like. And I said, "Well, Glenn, what does the job pay?" He said, "Well, I'm paying everybody in the band $50 straight, right? 50 each man per week." And I don't know why I said what I did, but I thought for a moment, and I said, well, I'll come with the band, Glenn, for $52.50 a week. I wanted to make two and a half more than anybody else did. Well, of course, he called me a couple of dirty names and said, well, I'll give it to you. So that's how I went with the band. And this was back in April of April 38. And then he disbanded because of the draft around the middle of October 42. And but that was, I think, one of the most rewarding periods that I have ever had.
He did an awful lot in that short period of time.
He was always featuring me, you know, as a soloist, as a saxophonist, and also as a vocalist. And he had me working with the Modern Airs and on many, many recordings.
He put you in the movies, made a big movie star.
I had one line, I think.
Well, wasn't Jackie Gleason in one of your bands
Gleason
in the movies?
Was, this was his second movie in 42 called Orchestra Wives. And, of course, all the music was pre-recorded, you know, but Gleason was supposed to be the bass player. And Cesar Romero, the piano player. And neither one of them could play, you know, but it looked good to see them up there laughing and having fun. And I think George Montgomery was in on trumpet. And... Well, it was just
well, you did your own
fun.
Singing in that, though, and sax playing.
Right? That is right,
Carl Pearson is a super Tex Beneke fan and Glenn Miller authority. I know he's waiting to ask you a couple of questions about this. Carl, here's a golden opportunity for you.
Well, one of the questions that I know, but I'm sure a lot of people would like to know, is how did the name Tex, how are you christened with the name Tex?
Well, Carl, I was, as I mentioned, born in Texas, and... it seems that almost everyone who leaves Texas acquires that name, you know. And Glenn actually was the first one who tacked it on to me when I dropped into the studio for my first rehearsal. He said, well, hello there, Texas. And it stuck from that time on. So I had been driving for 24 hours through a blinding snowstorm from Detroit. And I had to climb three or four flights of stairs where he was rehearsing. And all I could see was snow still falling in my face. And I asked Glenn if I could please be excused for now that I had to get some sleep. I was dead. He said, get out your horn and let's hear you play. And he was the kind of a guy that when he told you to do something, you did it, you know. But as we were going through the book, he had had a band about a year or so before, 38, that didn't make it. And his tenor man at that time was, his second tenor man was a boy named Jerry Jerome, who was a studio man still, I think, in New York. And so we started out with that same library that he had to begin with. And as we would go through the tunes, he told me, he says, well, your solos sound pretty good. And then all of a sudden we hit one of the vocals. And he says, let's see what you can do with the song. Well, all I had ever sung before was a few... choruses of the blues that were on a little on the shady side, you know. And, so I tried, and it was a tune called Ida, Sweet as Apple Cider, and that's been one of my big ones ever since. So he said, well, fine, says, I'm going to write up some more things for you. So that's how that came about.
And there he got started. You were asked by Glenn Miller to join his Air Force band when he was drafted, weren't you?
Yes, in a way. The draft did hit him awfully hard, and he had tried. He knew he couldn't keep it going. He had tried to enlist the whole group as a unit, and there wasn't any branch of the service that would take an organized band at that time. So he thought, well, I'll go ahead and disband the thing, and he told all of us to try to keep from being drafted or don't enlist for a while or whatever until I can get something going. And it wasn't long until Uncle was breathing hard down my back, and I was working with Marion Hutton and the Modern Airs, and we were we formed an act, and we were playing theater engagements all around the country. And all of us, of course, hoping that we'd get the call from Glenn to come in with him. But it took too long, and I enlisted in the Navy to get a CPO rating, and that worked out pretty well for me. I had charge of two bands and gained a lot of experience before I actually formed or took over the remains of the Miller Group when they came back from Europe in 46. So that worked out very well that way.
But he did ultimately find a lot of his former musicians.
He did,
In his own band then, right?
He did finally get back a few of his originals, but I was already in the Navy and couldn't switch over at that time.
Before that, you were involved in many of the broadcasts that they did, the Chesterfield.
Oh, I did all
shows,
of those.
Every one of them.
All of those, all of his recordings and his Chesterfields and
giving away
dance engagements,
radio phonographs on Saturday afternoons,
USO shows. Yeah.
There was a period, I think, wasn't it, during early 1940, and the band was just grabbing hold, and there was something like six nights a week between sustaining remotes and Chesterfield shows. The band was on the air.
Well, we were on the air on the Chesterfields every Tuesdays and Thursdays, I believe it was. And, of course, we had to do two different broadcasts because there was no way of taping in those days. And we'd have to do one for the East Coast and one for the West Coast, you know. But getting back to the other thing, only about a month after Glenn disbanded, Clyde McCoy was able to go in to the service, into the Navy, with his whole group intact. And it was too late then for Glenn to get his group back together. But that was Miller's Air Force's band, I think, was one of the finest groups that ever existed. I was sorry I couldn't have been with it.
It was a loss that you weren't with it. But you were doing a pretty good job of yourself in the Navy.
Well, I felt it was wasted time because of all places to be in the Navy, I was right in the middle of Oklahoma. And people thought, what's the Navy doing in Oklahoma, you know? And we had a little creek about 12 feet wide with some rowboats on it, and that's the only water I ever saw. But it was a technical training base where they trained the cadets to train the flyers and trained them in motor mechanics and signaling, signal corps things, and all that sort of thing, or that would be that they would need when they did finally go to sea or become island-based someplace.
Carl?
There's one question. A lot of musicians, they always had an idol when they started out. You know, when a certain trumpet player would start, his idol was Bunny Berrigan. I was just wondering who your idol was, maybe on the tenor sax.
Oh, I don't know. I had so many of them, Carol. Primarily, I would say Coleman Hawkins.
Mm-hmm. It's surprising, too, because for 2 years... during the early 40s, you were picked for the Metronome All-Star Band.
Yes, and I think I managed to hit pretty high up on the downbeat polls there for a while.
And, well, anyways, you were in this, Coleman Hawkins, I believe, was in at least one of the bands, so you were playing
sitting right beside him.
Right.
I forget who all else was in the band. I know Harry James was in the band, and I think Krupa. And I thought those All-Star things turned out very well.
Sure. There's an interesting story about one of those all-star, I guess it was a recording session that you were included in, but you were playing with the Miller Band someplace.
Was at the Café Rouge, I think.
You were at the Café Rouge.
We were at the Café Rouge, yeah. We were there 3 months every summer.
Mm-hmm. And you wanted to get off the bandstand early to get over to the recording session.
Well, what we tried to do was to wait for the recording session until as many of the big bands were in town as possible so they could get all the guys together. Well, they always had to wait also until about 2 in the morning, you know, before beginning the session so the guys could finish their engagements. But Glenn and I always got along so great together, and all the rest of the guys in the band knew that we were very close friends. So this one night, he and I cooked up a little bit, and we were getting on the platform for the last session of the evening, and Glenn started to call out 6 or 8 numbers that he thought would be appropriate for the last closing, you know, that night. And knowing all the time that I had to get off and I couldn't make that last thing, so as he would call the different numbers, I started to grumble and gripe about the tunes he was calling, and the little Mexican baritonist, Ernie Caceres, was sitting right next to me, and he kept nudging me in the ribs, said, hey, cool it, the old man hears you. The old man can hear you. And I said, I don't care whether he hears me or not. And he called a few more, and finally he came over and says, what did you say, Texas? I said, Glenn, I think the last set, the tunes you're calling, stink. People here don't want to hear those. They don't want to hear those for a closing set. He said, well, then why don't you just pack your horns and get out? You're finished. So I got my tenor, and I was playing flute and clarinet at the time. I started up across the dance floor, and Ernie, believe it or not, picked up his baritone and his alto and his clarinet. He says, that goes for me, too. So he started to follow me, and then Johnny Best was going to do the same thing. So this burned Glenn up. It burned him up to find out that those guys would go with me rather than stay with him, you know. So we had to bear the whole plot right there, and I don't think he spoke to any of those guys for months after that.
Well, you and Glenn had cooked this up.
Yeah,
so
right.
So that you could
get
away early.
So that I could
early.
Get away early for the All-Star session. That was kind of funny in a way, you know.
Did you do much on the road? Were you on the road in buses? Were you traveling like that a lot?
Well, we traveled by train a lot. Glenn had two railroad cars called the GM1 and GM2, and we would rehearse a lot of times in the baggage car and time all the tunes that we were going to have to play on the Chesterfield shows as soon as we got into the town, you know. And when we weren't traveling by train, we were in a bus quite a number of times, but primarily we traveled in cars.
Oh, I see.
We did a lot of driving. And the booking offices, of course, had our tours lined up, our dates lined up, so that they were easily makeable. Of course, sometimes we wouldn't get to bed until about 6, 7, or 8, or even 9 in the morning after traveling all night after the job. But Glenn and Hal McIntyre and Chummy McGregor, Chummy the piano player, and McIntyre, his lead alto, they would always go out and play golf, no matter how tired they were, whatever. Then come in and sleep the afternoon, and then work that night.
You always would travel after the
well, it all depended. It all depended, Chuck. If sometimes we would get what we called a twofer. All the guys always wanted to get a twofer if they could. This amounts to two sleeps for one pay in the different hotels. And the road manager would try to work it so that we would get in on the day sheet and we could sleep that day, play the job that night, and go back to bed. So we're getting two sleeps for one pay. But it was kind of funny because the boys couldn't sleep too well in a bed because it wasn't moving. And it wasn't jiggling, you know. They got better sleep on the bus and in the cars than they did in a regular hotel. No, a lot of funny things happened.
Did you often rehearse on the bus?
No, that was impossible because there just wasn't room, you see, because we needed music stands and all those things to be set up.
All the illusions are gone now. See, all the
we didn't rehearse on the bus because where are you going to put your music in the first place?
Right.
You know, if they're brand new arrangements and you haven't seen them before, and it just wouldn't have worked that way. But our road manager always seemed to work it out so that we would get in plenty of time, you know, to do our rehearsals and get everything done before the air shows or whatever.
You broadcast from various parts of the country.
Various parts of the country, yeah, all over. And we took a producer with us, and he clocked and timed everything and set all the mics and everything. He knew exactly the sound that Glenn wanted, and he knew on each stage exactly where to put everything, and we had quite a little gang traveling around, you know.
The radio broadcast really
that was everything.
Did it all for you, didn't it?
That was everything, because there hadn't been too many traveling bands at that time, too many so-called named traveling bands. And the broadcasts, the people that would hear them, naturally they had to see their favorite group, you know, so they would drive hundreds of miles sometimes. Like out in West Texas, you'd set up in some farmer's barn out there and think, my God, where are they going to come from tonight, you know? But it would be packed. It would be packed. They just had to hear their favorite bands. And this is all coming back. It really is. They're ganging up around the bandstand and just like they used to do at the old Hollywood Palladium and the old Hotel Sherman, the Panther Room, and Edgewater Beach. And
these are places where you've played, too.
Yeah, right, years, huh? Right, yeah.
the Palladium was a sensational
showcase
spot for you.
Yeah,
right. When you had, after the war, when it was Tex Beneke and the orchestra,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Did you break all records over there one night?
Yes, we
one
did. I think we had over 6,000 there one night, which is still holds a record, I believe. Of course, I don't know. I think Welk probably puts quite a few in there now. But,
that's right. That's where he does his regular TV shows and all of that.
That's right. Yeah.
So, Carl?
Well, when was the first time, since we're talking about the band that broke the records at the Palladium, when did you find out, or when were you contacted about leading a post-war orchestra, a Glenn Miller orchestra?
Well, Glenn had wanted me, Carl, to, he had wanted to back me with my own band before he broke up his other band, since he had backed Hal McIntyre, Charlie Spivak, and Claude Thornhill. And when he approached me on this subject, I told him, I said, Glenn, I'm sorry, I don't think I'm ready for the to become a leader yet and all the responsibilities. And Mrs. Miller knew of these plans. So when Glenn disappeared and didn't come back, why, she said, I think Tex is the logical one to take it over, because this is what Glenn had. Glenn was going to give him a band anyway after a few months' time, you know. So I was scared to death, but I took it over, and it seemed to work out all right for us. One of our first engagements was the Capitol Theater for 8 weeks in New York. And one of the acts, our names were up there in huge headlines. And way down at the bottom was Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, added attraction. So every time I see them now, we have a few laughs about some of those things. You know.
How long did you lead the, I guess there's an official Glenn Miller Orchestra.
There is another band now mm-hmm. that is owned by Glenn's attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I understand, is trying to buy out the Miller children so that it will become strictly, still be the Glenn Miller, the new Glenn Miller Orchestra, but McKay himself wants to own the mm-hmm. thing. And I don't know what's going on between him and Glenn's two children, but that's the way it is set up as of now. They're the only ones allowed legally to call it the new Glenn Miller mm-hmm. Orchestra. And Jimmy Henderson, a trombonist, fine trombonist, is in charge. And it's had numerous leaders: Ray McKinley, Peanuts Hucko, Buddy DeFranco. Golly, I can't tell you how many more. But Henderson is really doing great things with the band, and it is a good band.
Well, it was that band, excuse me, the official Glenn Miller Orchestra that you took over. You were the leader
well,
of.
When I took it
right
over
at the beginning,
in
right?
46, everyone mm-hmm. in the band was direct from his uh-huh. Air Force's mm-hmm. group.
I see.
And then gradually they wanted to do other things, mm-hmm. so it kept getting a little thinner and thinner on the original Miller personnel. So finally, about 1950, I dropped the violin section. There were 12 strings there, and business just wasn't quite what it should be, and I had a tremendous payroll, so I naturally had to drop the strings mm-hmm. first. Still maintaining, however, four trumpets, four trombones, French horn, five saxes, four rhythm, and a vocal quartet, plus a girl and boy singer, so we still had a big group. But then I finally had to make a few more cuts because rock had come in, you know, and the big band sound just wasn't being accepted as well as it had been in the past. But now I'm starting to add men back again and having the arrangers rewrite some things, you know, so that they'll sound good. I worked for a long time with just five brass mm-hmm. and five saxes and three rhythm and myself. But it's all coming back, which I'm very happy to see a new era, you know, see it happen again.
The we get a chance to look at and hear what's happening today with this great style and type of music at Ravinia on the 10th of August.
I think people are going to love it, Chuck. I really do.
What can we look forward to seeing and hearing there? What kind of
Naturally, I have to dig out the old chestnuts,
all
you
right.
know. Naturally, I've got to do Moonlight Serenade and String of Pearls and Ida and Chattanooga and Kalamazoo and Little Brown Jug, American Patrol, St. Louis Blues March, mm-hmm. Oh, there are many others that don't come to mind right at the moment. Normally, I do the first half of the show in the Miller vein, mm-hmm. and bring Bob Eberly out during the middle of my segment, and he does a medley of some of Ray's tunes, his brother's things. Mm-hmm. And then after that section is over, we take a breather, and then the whole last half of the show is the Jimmy Dorsey things with Helen O'Connell and Bob. And then we usually wrap up the show, all three of us out front singing Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree.
Oh, so. Gee. The nostalgic sounds of the summer of 42.
Right.
They really have lasted, though.
Oh,
they
yeah.
really have.
They're just as big now as they were.
What would you consider a real highlight of your career?
Well, I think the biggest thing that ever happened to me was that getting the opportunity to go with Miller.
Mm-hmm. Has to be.
That has to be. Yeah. Because he taught me so much about, not just about becoming a leader, but how to phrase, how to blow, how to breathe properly, even though he didn't play saxophone. And there wasn't a boy in that band that that didn't come out of there much smarter than he went in, I'll tell you.
He was a tough taskmaster, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was quite strict, but he never would chew anybody out, you mm-hmm. know. I mean, on the bandstand, he'd wait until they could get you back in the dressing room. But we all knew that when he said, I want this, that he meant that. And you did it to the best of your ability. If you made a mistake, he'd tell you later. He would say, look, I know that nobody's perfect, but if you're going to make a mistake, make a good one, because I want to hear you blowing. I want to hear you up there at all times. Says, make it good and loud so everybody can hear it, but don't make it again in the same spot. Make a mistake someplace else.
Well, it paid off. His authoritarian attitude towards this, being a tough bandmaster, because you know, how many other bands from that era are still? You know, can you still listen to these the records and hear the sounds from today?
Well, there's still a few, you know. There's Woody still around, and poor Kenton, if he ever gets out of that hospital. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's several more, but I, offhand, I can't remember just who they are.
Carl, I know, is itching with another question.
What is it, Carl?
Well, I was just looking back at my notes, and I know that the bands that you've led, you've had various number of musicians that have two have gone on to greater things. You've had arrangers like Jerry Gray and Norm Laden. You had Henry Mancini, who also ended up playing piano for a while.
Right, and Billy May, of course, does a lot of writing for me even now. And we were working in the Steel Pier at Atlantic City one night, and my girl vocalist was leaving the band in a week or two, and a little girl showed up backstage with an autograph book and said, Mr. Beneke, I'd like very much to get the autographs of all the boys. I said, sure. She said, my name is Edie Gourmet, and I do a little singing with a little New Jersey band. I said, would you like to audition? And it scared her to death. We had to push her out on the stage, but she went out there and broke it up. We just got something going there with the rhythm section, you know. And she did a great job. Came with me for almost 3 years, I think. And until she might still have been with me, I don't know, if Steve Lawrence hadn't shown up on the scene. And, of course, they fell in love and got married. And I've lost so many girl vocalists to musicians in the band. They say, oh, we're not going to leave. We're going to stay with you. But then a couple of months later, hey, we're going to pull out, you know, and do something on our own.
Mm-hmm. Was there a good spirit amongst the members of the band as they travel? You know, working in such close quarters constantly, you say you're traveling in a bus or a train or even a couple of cars and every night doing a lot together.
Chuck, I don't remember any guys ever getting mad at anybody else in that band. It was great. Now, a lot of the boys would rather have gone with Goodman or Charlie Barnett, or Woody, or because some of those bands, Tommy Dorsey, were actually greater swing bands than Miller had. Mm-hmm. Miller's was like a huge pipe organ. It was just beautiful, you know. And a lot of them were offered more money at times to go with the other bands, but they say, no, I think we'll stick with Glenn, and because they liked him. They liked the band, and everything worked out fine. But leaders were very bold in those days. I guess maybe they still are, because sometimes Goodman had been in the Café Rouge and propositioning our boys off in the corner. And Glenn found out about it and kicked him out one night.
Well, he wanted the best.
That's right.
He wanted the best.
Yeah.
And you are the best. You've done some great work, and we're glad that you're coming back to town to share some of the best.
Well,
of
I do. I do get around to Chicago quite often, but primarily they are private affairs. Mm-hmm. You know, like country clubs, where just the members of the club know that that you're even in town. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I've had so many people say, "Where have you been all these years?" I said, "Well, I've been right here in your town a dozen times," and. They can't understand why they all can't be wide open dates, you know, for the public to be able to attend.
Your home base now is in St. Louis.
Well, I have my home there and my wife, and of course I'm just physically not up to seven nights a week on the road anymore. Mm-hmm. And I like to get home because I have to answer mail, and it's stacked up on me when I get back, and. And I like to, I don't even mind cutting my grass once in a while. And, I work as much as I want to work, Chuck, let's put it that
way. That's great. That's good.
I have to turn down a lot of lucrative dates, but they just come too soon after others or mm-hmm. all sandwiched in together. And pretty soon I find out I'm back out doing nothing but one-nighters again.
Yeah.
So I like to get home every now and then.
Well, we're glad you come this way once in a while, too.
Oh, I get up here at least 15, 20 times a year.
Good. Well, we're all going to be out at Ravinia on the 10th. That's on Wednesday, the 10th of August. Right, Carol?
Right.
I'm sure we can promise everybody a very, very nostalgic evening.
It'd be a wonderful evening. Thank you very much, Tex Benning.
Thank you, Chuck. Thank you, Carl.